Welcome to Interviews for Resistance. We are now several months into the Trump administration, and activists have scored some important victories in those months. Yet there's always more to be done, and for many people, the question of where to focus and how to help remains. In this series, we talk with organizers, agitators, and educators, not only about how to resist, but how to build a better world. I'm Sarah Jaffe, your host.
Hi, I'm Marshall Steinbaum. I'm the research director and a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute.
All right. And so we are going to talk about Trump's tax plan. This has been threatened since the election, I guess, and we're finally seeing something. So give us a rundown on what is in it and what would that do?
Yeah. So the basic thrust of the proposal is more of the same right-wing tax policy that we've been seeing play out over the last 40 years. And I would say not just that, but a sort of supercharged version of that, where they've sloughed off a few of the elements that weren't core to previous proposals, like some tax cuts for middle-income people. And instead, they've just sort of gone full bore straight toward huge tax cuts for people who rely on their wealth to make their living.
Yeah. That's a good way of framing that. Can you dig into that a little bit more and talk about what it means to mostly target tax cuts as people who are essentially living off capital?
Yes. So capital is an economic concept, and it's a somewhat abstract and also imprecise one. There's sort of a robust debate about whether capital reflects something that's economically productive that contributes to the national income versus some just the sort of fruits of past accumulation and future claims on wealth. So are people who live off their capital income deriving the benefits of productive investment, or are they basically leeching off the rest of the economy? And, you know, it's not so clear in practice. These are big questions that, you know, there is no one correct answer. In the U.S. tax system, there's a few different ways that we tax capital. So what we have never really done in the U.S., except for a few specific instances, is what would be called a wealth tax. So just look at the total amount of wealth that people own and tax some percentage of that big pile. Instead, we tax various forms of capital income, and the main way that we do that, the main ways that we have done that is through, first of all, taxing the profits of corporations, so that's the corporate income tax or the corporate profits tax. Secondly, we tax the capital gains of people who own capital. Basically, if the value of your capital goes up, we tax some percentage of the of the wealth increase. And a few other ways, estate taxation is what we do, and that would also be considered a tax on capital. We also tax dividends, so that's a flow of income deriving. Quintessentially, a dividend is an annual or quarterly payment that a company makes to its shareholders, so that's part of the individual tax system, and we tax dividend income as well. So all of these are different ways in which a concrete tax system taxes either the total amount or more likely the income generated by the amount of capital that exists in the economy. And the right in this country has pursued over now four decades or more a single-minded policy of cutting taxes on all forms of capital income or capital itself. And that is really the central thrust of this tax plan.
Right. And so they have, as you said, sort of dropped all pretense that there was going to be anything for working people in this tax plan. What has the reaction been to that from, you know, different corners of the Trumpiverse, I guess? And
I mean, I should say that is my interpretation of their plan. They would give you a very different account of what, for instance, cutting effective tax rates on corporations would do. And specifically, there's this big debate about whether corporate taxes are actually paid by workers. And, of course, the Trump people and their associated hangers-on and acolytes and the, you know, quasi-academic economist community will tell you that corporate taxes are actually paid by workers. So if you cut corporate taxes, you're actually increasing wages. And I think that the economic evidence on that question is very definitively against it. And so anyone who says it can basically be assumed to not know what they're talking about or be ideologically motivated. But it plays a critical role in the debate, I would say, because they have made promises to the effect that their tax plan will not cause inequality to increase. And that's just obviously wrong, but the role of assumptions like that cutting corporate taxes benefits workers, the role that that plays is in being, allowing them to come out and say, this tax cut is not going to work in inequality because workers will benefit, even though in reality it will. I mean, there's no provision of the tax legislation that's going to say, well, if it does turn out that this does worsen inequality, then these tax cuts are retracted. It's all, you know, this is all about the propaganda that is necessary to move the legislative proposal. The politics of this are basically that, you know, the Republicans control both houses of Congress, and they are more or less ideologically unified behind extremely regressive tax cut for capital income. But there are some people, some members of the caucus who have expressed sort of red lines or lines in the sand to the effect that either they will not vote for tax cuts that increase the deficit, or they will not vote for tax cuts that worsen inequality, or both. So what the administration and its allies in Congress are doing right now is trying to assemble together the necessary kind of rhetorical weaponry in order to get those votes on their side when they need them to get the thing over the finish line.
Right. And so, yeah, there's obviously a lot here to unpack, but the basics are things we're sort of familiar with. You know, so Trump ran on this promise, this sort of break from theoretical Republican orthodoxy and this tendency to sort of talk about actual working people like they have real needs. And now we see this. We've seen it at the end of a summer where they've been repeatedly trying to take away health care from millions of people. What are the odds of this thing, I guess, actually getting passed in some version?
I mean, I'm not your go-to source for voting on Capitol Hill, but I would say they're high. There's a real possibility of defeating it, but nothing unifies the Republican caucus like huge tax cuts for rich people, and that's all they need to do, unify the Republican caucus. The only way to have it not be passed is more or less the same way that healthcare was blocked, which is to say, peel off a couple of critical Republican votes who would be convinced through some combination of public pressure, shaming, and a press campaign and town halls and so on, that the tax plan violates some red line that they had previously stated. So, like, for instance, I want to check on this, but I believe Senator Corker said when he was retiring that he would not vote for a plan that increases the deficit. Okay, so that's one vote. They're going to trot out all manner of nonsense prognostications that say that the tax cut won't increase the deficit or will do so in a small way because by unleashing economic growth, it will cause federal revenues to increase and therefore it won't be deficit increasing. So all of this is, again, part of the rhetorical weaponry they need to assemble in order to get the votes they need to get the thing over the finish line. And the only way to stop it is, you know, given that the Republicans have a slim majority in the Senate, is to prevent it from getting those votes.
I want to talk about a little bit about my favorite little bugbear, which is a Change CPI, which may or may not be returning in this sort of proposal. So can you explain to people what that is? Because it comes up a lot and people like me are obsessed with it. But
this is actually not my area of expertise. Back when there was this whole debt ceiling / grand bargain debate in the summer of 2011, there was this idea that we needed to both cut government spending over the long term because entitlement programs were growing too quickly and the federal revenue wasn't sufficient to pay for them, and also increase taxes, and that the grand bargain was going to be some combination of those two things. And so change CPI is basically a way of reducing what are currently legislated automatic cost of living increases under Social Security and possibly under some other programs. That's what I'm not sure about, but I think I think Social Security was the main one. So the way Social Security is currently, quote, indexed to inflation, that as earnings increase on average over time, there's some index that Social Security benefits increase over time. And the idea here is that Social Security is supposed to be basically wage insurance for after you retire. So after you're not working, you should still be insured so that you get some labor income. That is to say, you're deferring labor income from your lifetime or from your working life to your retirement. And the premise behind the current system of indexing the increases in those benefits to changes in earnings is that if the overall rate of increase of earnings in the economy goes up, then beneficiaries of Social Security should in some sense be cut into that deal. Change CPI, on the other hand, is saying, well, instead of indexing the cost of living increases under Social Security, increasing cost of living increases to changes in earnings, we'll index them to changes in the cost of consumption and in general consumption, earnings inflation. And this is why that including that in the proposal for the grand bargain was going to reduce the cost of Social Security's of paying Social Security benefits in the long term. I mean, I guess sort of in a very kind of actuarial sense, green eye shades type analysis, Social Security revenues are increasing along with the rate of earnings and inflation because that's what Social Security taxes are, just a percentage of earnings. If you put payments on a different track that is increasing across their cost of living changes according to consumption, then the long-term inflation will be at a lower rate, and that will cause the system to become more solvent over the long term. It's almost quaint to talk about this, in my opinion, because one thing that should be said, I guess, right off the bat is that going from the current system to change CPI would be a cut in Social Security benefits. I feel like there was a lot of kind of kicking up dust around that, whether it would count as a cut versus not. But the whole point of the policy is to reduce the cost of Social Security, and it would be a cut. It's a cut that the idea is that people don't kind of tune into the fact that their benefits have been cut, so they don't fight against them as hard. But that's what it is. Secondly, it's kind of interesting because, first of all, now we've been, more than 5 years, but since 2011 and the whole grand bargain debate, I guess that's 6 years now, which is saying that, earnings inflation, which we thought would be high, and therefore if we go to some lower rate of inflation, that would reduce the cost of earnings of Social Security benefits. Now we've been in, years of debate about wage stagnation, which kind of puts the lie to whether this is even an issue. Now, I haven't actually pored over the Social Security trustees report in a couple of years now, since it's been a little bit off the public radar screens. So I don't know exactly what they are projecting for the rate of growth of earnings over the long term versus the rate of growth of consumption. I'm guessing their long-term forecasts have not changed all that much since 2011. And in that, whereas I would say wage stagnation really is a great threat in the, not just in the immediate term, but for the long term. And therefore it's time to kind of shift the focus of, what's wrong with the economy to why are people underemployed? Why are wages stagnant? Why have normal people not been able to enjoy the benefits of the economic recovery that have gone almost exclusively to the top?
We're looking at this sort of coming at the end of a year of various Trump proposals and various Trump appointees, I guess, RIP the career of Tom Price. But we've seen this I guess my question is right that like Trump ran and essentially, you know, won by pretending to be different from regular Republicans. And as far as we've seen on economic policy issues, he has not been particularly different. I'm wondering if you sort of over the last year see any places where he has actually done anything that, you know, your sort of Mitch McConnell, Paul Ryan Republican wouldn't have done.
No, absolutely not. There is none, because there is no gap whatsoever on economic issues between Donald Trump, Mitch McConnell, and Paul Ryan. Even on trade, which was the place rhetorically where he got furthest away from Republican orthodoxy, the so-called promise to renegotiate NAFTA has just become a promise to take all of the pro-corporate provisions that were in the canceled TPP and like shove them into NAFTA, which all that reflects is the kind of burgeoning agenda of the corporate sector when it comes to trade negotiations as developed in the, you know, whatever 25 years it's been since NAFTA was passed. You know, that's that constitutes a huge growth of corporate priorities in trade, and he wants to take that from the most recent trade negotiation and shove that into the one that's 25 years old. So it's make it his promise to renegotiate NAFTA is making NAFTA more pro-corporate. It is the exact opposite of what he ostensibly promised on the campaign trail. And everywhere else, it's just been, you know, not even a question that this administration is more of the same Republican policies, except in some sense, as I was saying at the beginning, even more pared down from the sort of window dressing that had been a part of past policy agendas.
And so on that front, what is sort of the best argument if people are doing a full court sort of campaign against this tax, these tax proposals? What is the best way to get, to sort of rally the opposition to this?
Yeah, I would, I'm actually working on a piece right now about exactly that.
There you go.
That
we'll
point, and I would, and I would answer that question very frankly at two different registers. So if all you want to do is block this proposal, all that matters is rallying the same few Senate votes that were rallied on health care to block it. And if you want to do that, all you have to do is point out, I mean, not all you have to do, it's a task, but what you have to do is point out and hammer home the idea that this is, one, increasing the federal debt when the Republicans have been promising for decades, especially during the Obama administration, that the federal debt was a big problem, and two, that all it was going to do was make the rich richer. That's what you have to do. Find the red lines that these senators have put forward in their past statements and on the campaign trail in the past. Stack their town meetings with people saying, why are you going back on your promise to not increase the deficit? Get that hammered home in the media, and that's how you get the votes necessary to that would be necessary if you wanted to block this. I don't think that alone is a sufficient strategy, however, and it worries me a bit that you know, the opposition will take too much of a laser focus on that one question to miss the larger significance of this debate, which is to say that we need to have a conversation about how the economy works, and specifically about the role of tax policy, and especially progressive tax policy, in structuring how the economy works. So this isn't just about, do we give a lot of money to people who are already inheriting a lot of money by eliminating the estate tax, or do we increase the after-tax profit rates of companies that are already extremely profitable thanks to corporate giveaways and captive markets and consolidation and anti-competitive behavior. This is how you structure the economy. That is to say, get rid of progressive taxation. That is how you structure the economy in order to reward the powerful at the expense of everybody else, in order to increase the incentives that shareholders of large and profitable corporations and the executives of those corporations, who are very often the same people as the shareholders, that's how you create the incentive for them to suck the economy dry, which is what they have been doing for the last 40 years. We have eliminated progressive taxation in this country, or vastly reduced it, and the effect of that has been to increase the incentive that rich people and powerful people have to dominate the economy to their own benefit. We used to have a statutory maximum individual income tax rate of like 90% over a very high income. And that, what that is basically making it illegal to be rich. And not surprisingly, if you make it illegal to be rich, people don't want to be as rich as they used to be. I mean, we used to, and I was, you know, having this debate about the history of progressive taxation in the United States. There were no rich people by today's standards in 1960, like none. Now we have tons of them, and they are richer than they ever were before, and that's because we stopped taxing them, and so it became more worthwhile to earn more. So if you're wondering why the owners of, you know, one gigantic profitable corporation would want to merge with another gigantic profitable corporation and cut tens of thousands of workers and chop off their supply chain and raise prices to consumers because you have no other place to go, that is exactly why. If their tax rates were still 90%, it would be illegal to increase their income from where it currently is, more or less, and there would be no incentive to do that.
Yeah. Excellent. So how can people keep up with you and your ongoing work on this subject?
Well, I tweet quite a bit. I'm at econ_Marshall. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I also write a lot both for the Roosevelt Institute, its website, and other publications. I have my forthcoming piece, and yeah, look forward to hearing from people.
Interviews for Resistance is a project of Sarah Jaffe with assistance from Laura Fayebois and support from the Nation Institute. You can find more information at necessarytrouble.org. Thanks for listening.